Sri Krishna Prem's Visit to Sri Ramana Maharshi by S. Chakravarti, Part 5, continued from the November-December 2019 issue. S. Chakravarti's description of Sri Krishna Prem's visit to the Maharshi in 1948 was published in the May-June 2019 through November-December 2019 issues. After these 6 intervening years, the conclusion of these reminiscences is recorded below. Anyone interested in Krishna Prem's visit to Bhagwan can reread the story from the beginning to better appreciate the progression of events. The Maharshi took great interest when told of the following events which took place after Krishna Prem's visit to Sri Ramanashramam. Asher Bhai took leave of Gopalda. That was how Sri Krishna Prem was known. A few of his compatriots stood by the window of the compartment and were conversing with Gopalda. Suddenly, Gopalda again referred to his desire to have Sri Ranganatha Swami's darshan at the Srirangam temple and how that desire could not be translated into action. Those persons looked at their watches, consulted amongst themselves, and then informed Gopalda that perhaps all was not lost yet. They told us that only recently a new train service had been introduced, which would leave Trichy at about 2 a.m., and they would take us to Srirangam in their car and bring us back again in time to catch this new train. But they wondered if Gopalda would reach the temple before it was closed. As soon as Gopalda heard this, he jumped out of the compartment, dumped the jhola which contained his clothes on the platform, and told us to do the same. I tried to draw his attention to the inadvisability of abandoning our jholas, but he cut me short and said, "Oh, for God's sake, do what I say and run." Before we could get our wits back, he was disappearing down the platform with his giant strides. I had to run, literally, to catch up with Gopalda. My heart, however, was heavy with the thought that I was probably going to lose the rug I bought in England, in which I was carrying my few clothes. I admit I attached, and still attach, sentimental value to this rug, which kept me company ever since 1935-36. We jumped into the car and were driven to Srirangam. There, we descended on our previous hosts, who appeared to be happy to see Gopalda again so unexpectedly. Gopalda requested them not to put themselves out on our account. They must not cook food for us. Any leftover would do. As for himself, he would take only some buttermilk. Gopalda had to go to the lavatory and he had a hurried bath. Then he started to run for the temple lest the door should be closed before we could get there. Upadhyaya and I tried our best to keep up with him. As we came in sight of the main entrance door of the temple, we saw that one panel of the door was already closed and the gateman was on the point of closing the other one. Gopalda gave the man no chance to complete this duty. Before he could realize what Gopalda was up to, Gopalda slipped through the half-closed door. The man started shouting something in a loud voice in Tamil, I suppose, but Gopalda was out of sight and hearing before he could get his breath back. That gave us also the chance to slip through. That was a close shave indeed. Those who are acquainted with South Indian temples are aware of the distance between the main entrance door and the actual shrine. This distance is again divided into 2 or 3 walled-off enclaves. Gopalda, followed closely by Upadhyaya and me, kept running until he arrived before the shrine. The fateful moment had arrived. What did we see? the door of the shrine was closed. Gopalda dropped down on the floor and bent his head. I cannot speak for Upadhyaya, but I was torn between two warring emotions. One part of my mind was elated. It kept saying, "It serves you right. We warned you, but you would not listen to any of us. You put all of us to this pointless and endless trouble by your whimsy. Now see, you realize what a fool you have made of yourself. Pooh, you and your Thakur." But the other part of my mind could not but feel sorry for that bent figure in front of my eyes, a figure dejected with his head hidden between two drawn-up knees. Some moments passed. Not a soul was in sight. My concern was how to get out of the temple. The front door was closed. Was there any other egress? Must we spend the whole night inside this temple? I summoned up enough courage to whisper to Gopalda, imploring him to come away. He looked up at me and beseeched me to give him a little more time, and he again bent his head. Seconds, minutes ticked away. What was going to happen? What can I do? A figure emerged from the semi-dark interior with a long stick and a sort of cap at the end in his hand. With that stick, he kept extinguishing one candle after another in the huge candelabra hanging from the high ceiling. The man looked at us in surprise and said something. Evidently, he wanted to convey that we could not wait any longer. I tried to get some idea of a back exit from him, but he knew no English. Gopalda said piteously something like, "Must we go without Thakur's darshan?" "I suppose so. Please give me just a few more seconds." We two stood there like a couple of fools. Another figure appeared from the now darkened precinct. He was making sure that the temple door was closed properly, the lights were out, and so on. He saw us, came up to Gopalda, and looked at him closely. He then said something and gestured with his right hand. He beckoned us to follow him. This person appeared to be a priest who was not used to having his orders disobeyed. Gopalda looked at him silently and then stood up. I heaved a sigh of relief, but alas, I was soon singing another tune. We three followed this person. I was certain that he was going to lead us to a back door. We passed the back of the shrine and soon found that we were treading a stone-covered passage. I admit I started having doubts about the motives of our guide. My misgivings were boundless when I found that the tortuous pathway we were treading narrowed down to a sort of aisle, hardly 3 feet broad. The roof sloped down. Even a short man like me had to bend his head. Gopalda was almost crawling. I thought we were being abducted by this person, but drew solace from the fact that we had no money on us. Gradually, the alleyway straightened out and we could stand again. And then, that unbelievable and unforgettable moment, the impossible thing had happened. We were ushered into a room by this person. I looked around and could not believe my eyes. I was speechless with amazement. We were standing in front of that huge reclining figure or murti of Vishnu, commonly called Anantashayana. I could not blame anyone who came to read this account and dismissed it as a figment of my imagination. As I said before, I myself wonder if I did not dream the whole thing. This person took up one of those large brass lamps found in all South Indian temples and brought it near the Vigraha so that Gopalda could see distinctly. Oh, what a sight indeed! I cannot give a detailed description because my mind was numb with shock and surprise. Besides, I was watching Gopalda all the time. Gopalda flung himself on this enormous reclining figure. He was crying profusely. He would be hugging the breast one moment, and at the next he was washing the feet of the image with his tears. The guide sort of encouraged Gopalda, who was half mad by then. I cannot say how long this went on, for I had lost count of time. The guide replaced the brass lamp and motioned us to follow him. When we came out of the Garbhagriha, Gopalda needed some time to recover his normal composure. At last, this person showed us out of the temple building by a back door and indicated the way that would lead us to the main road. We walked back silently to our host's house. There, we had a hurried meal and were driven back to Trichy. Our friends left us in the waiting room and took leave of Gopalda. So that was that. But how about the jholas we had left on the platform? And how about my rug? All along, I had been telling myself to accept the loss of that rug. I could get another rug, couldn't I? Well, yes, but it wouldn't be the same rug. Then, as we took our seats in the waiting room, the man in charge appeared with the three jholas. He told us that someone had left them with instructions to hand them over to the European Mahatma, who would come later with two other persons. Who was it? It must have been either Asher Bhai himself or one of his friends. We spread blankets on the floor of the waiting room and laid down to rest, telling the caretaker to let us know when the train arrived. Gopalda was not complaining about his diarrhea, so we took it for granted that he was feeling better. The train was a bit crowded when it arrived, but we boarded it and found a vacant lower berth for Gopalda, who was looking very tired indeed. He laid down to rest, while we too sat on our bundles in the corridor. Fool that I am, I thought we had left the last of our troubles behind us. I appear never to learn from experience. As I sat there, past events kept unfolding themselves in my mind. I thought I was in a cinema hall watching a picture. The question that exercised my mind most was, can one dismiss this incredible series of happenings as mere coincidence? Or is there really some other explanation? My attention was suddenly drawn to a person who kept looking through the windows of every compartment. I could see he was in a great hurry, evidently looking for someone, and he looked worried. As soon as he saw us, he inquired if we were not disciples of the European Mahatma. Then he implored me to take him to Gopalda. He was in great distress and said it was a must with him. I hesitated as Gopalda was having a badly needed rest, but I had to give in when he assured me that it was a question of life and death. He succeeded in arousing my curiosity too, for no one would care to come to the station at that unearthly hour unless he was under a pressing need. I found Gopalda lying with his eyes closed, and I had to do the unkind duty of waking him. When he heard my account, he came out of the compartment. This person was then joined by another person who was no other than our erstwhile temple guide. The first gentleman introduced himself as one of the trustees of the Sri Rangam Temple Administration Board and his companion as the head Purohit. The Purohit was standing with bowed head, crying. The following is more or less what the trustee told Gopalda. He said that he was suddenly woken up by the Purohit half an hour or so ago, who told him that he had committed the gravest possible sin for which there was no possible prayaschitta or atonement. so he had decided to commit suicide by drowning himself in the Kaveri River in the morning. The Purohit had related to the trustee how he had not only admitted a Yavana, or a foreigner, into the Garbhagriha of the temple, but had also helped him to touch the sacred Murti. I must explain to those who are not acquainted with the strict rules observed in South India that except for those Brahmins who are actually engaged in and entrusted with the performance of the daily puja, no one else, I repeat, no one else is allowed to cross the threshold from where all devotees, irrespective of their caste and creed, must have their darshan. In reply to a further question from the trustee, the Purohit assured him that he did not know how he came to do such a sacrilegious act. In fact, he did not remember anything about it. When he got home from the temple, he had his bath, took his meal, and retired as usual. Then he suddenly woke up, and the appalling gravity of what he had done dawned on him with a shattering blow. The trustee then called on our local host to find out our whereabouts and rushed to the station. He implored Gopalda to save him, the Purohit, and the unblemished history of the temple. What can or will Gopalda do now? I kept asking myself. I saw the same facial change in Gopalda once again. His eyes turned to slits, and he drew himself up to his full height. Then he embraced the Purohit and said, "No, you have not committed any sin." All this was Thakur's Leela. If you have any doubts, contact Ramana Maharshi and then act according to his advice. I don't remember whether or not the trustee translated Gopalda's words to the Purohit. All that I do remember is that the Purohit's face lit up with a smile through his tears and then dropped at Gopalda's feet. The trustee? He was overjoyed and was laughing. They stood there until the train left. I cannot and do not speak for Upadhyaya. My mind found that it could hardly bear the increasing load of miracles. I was restless, as I could find no easy answer to the riddle that kept pressing on my intellect. Gopalda was not physically well. He looked tired and worn out, but he kept refusing all medical attention. At last, we reached Pondicherry. When we arrived at Dilip's flat, Gopalda was not at all well. He laid himself down on the mattress in the front hall and told Dilip frankly that he was sorry, but he would not be able to attend Dilip's show. Dilip was furious with me for not consulting a doctor, and I explained to him how adamant Gopalda had been in this regard. Dilip sent some of the ashramites in search of a doctor, but due to the function, the normal routine of the ashram was disrupted, and no doctor was readily available. Gopalda kept reassuring Dilip that he need not worry in his account and that he would be quite all right with a little rest and sleep. He also told Dilip that Upadhyaya and I would act as his representatives. Dilip left soon afterwards. Gopalda was sleeping, and we two just sat there with our thoughts and worries. What next? Obviously, we appeared to be stuck in Pondicherry. Probably, Gopalda would not be able to leave Madras even on the scheduled date. Upadhyaya went to Dilip's show and was back after a very short stay. So did I. We just sat there as the night grew older. Once, a gentleman looked in to see how Gopalda was. He said he was a homeopath and he left some medicine. He said that sleep was the best medicine and that Gopalda's sleep should not be disturbed. If, after he got up, his stomach still caused trouble, he was to take the medicine he left with us. After another interval, Dilip rushed back home with a few others. Gopalda also woke up, and then he dropped the bomb. He told Dilip that he intended to leave Pondicherry by the next available train. No one could have been more astonished and angry than Dilip. He did eventually manage to give expression to his chagrin. "Krishna Prem, you are, must surely be, mad. Even if you want to leave, I cannot agree to it. Do you want your blood to be on my head? I have already sent a message to Sri Aurobindo. A doctor will soon come. You cannot and must not move. Besides, I must arrange for your meals." Gopalda stuck to his guns and said that he was well again and that his stomach was all right. He concluded saying forcefully that he was leaving. As for food, he said he needed nothing and that a scrappy meal would do for the two of us. I mentally tossed a coin and found that I won the toss. We were soon rolling down to the station. Dilip got our tickets. He really was perplexed and sorry. We boarded the train and Gopalda got a lower berth. A rather crestfallen Dilip stood on the platform. As the train left, Gopalda sat up on the berth, grinning like a mischievous brat and wagging his thumbs. In Bengali, it is called Kala Dekhano, meaning to show bananas, a form of cocking a snook. I was shocked by this pukish humor. Gopalda said, "Holona, holona, I couldn't attend Dilip's show, no wonder. Didn't I beg the Maharshi's blessings only for the three pilgrimages I had in mind?" Dilip kept pressing me to return to Pondicherry in spite of my repeated warnings. "Well, what do you see now?" Then he added, "My tummy too is normal. I told you I was taking my own medicine." Then he showed me some dried tulsi leaves. Gopalda had some shopping to do in Madras, so he stayed for a couple of days. When he was leaving by train, two amusing incidents occurred at the station. A young South Indian lady treated him to a long leftist harangue to which Gopalda listened smilingly. Then an English lady who was in the same compartment as Gopalda made some unkind remarks about Gopalda's religious beliefs. "Madam," he replied, "I at least have this," and he opened the case in which he was carrying the images of Radha and Krishna. "But what have you?" At last the mail train started for Calcutta and bore Gopalda out of sight, and I wended my way to the bus terminus for my return to Trivannamalai. The money I had borrowed from Jivarajani was almost untouched, and I still have that rug, a little more threadbare, a little more time-worn. On reaching Ramanashramam, I placed before the Maharshi the three separate lots of prasad collected from the three temples Gopalda had visited. The Maharshi instructed they be placed separately on a big thali he had called for. Then he took a pinch of prasad from all three lots and he applied sandalwood paste, vermilion and ash on his forehead and told the attendant to distribute to everyone in the ashram and to tell them the prasad was sent by Sri Krishna Prem. Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Ramanaya.